May it please the court, my name is Joe Corsaro. I've been certified by this court as a federal tax specialist. I also filed an amicus brief in the Nuss case. I'm here today representing five taxpayers, represented by case numbers 584, 579, 580, 586, 589. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for my rebuttal. I'd also like to note that during the course of my presentation, I'm not going to address all the issues in my brief. I'll let the brief speak for itself on those points. Why am I here? These taxpayers want their day in court. They're all denied a Board of Tax Appeals hearing. This denial was on the basis that their issues had already been decided in the Nuss case and that the Nuss decision was controlling. The Nuss case involved the interplay of two federal income tax statutes, Section 641 and 671. Section 641C deals with the taxation of electing small business trusts, which are sometimes referred to as ESBITs. Section 671 deals with the taxation of grantor trusts. Why is Nuss not controlling? Our issues were not in front of the Nuss court. Our first issue is the interplay between Section 641C and 671 ambiguous as it relates to the taxation of an ESBIT grantor trust whose tax year ended prior to 12/29/00. Our second issue, if a federal tax statute is ambiguous, is the ambiguity resolved in favor of the taxpayer? And further, our facts are distinguishable from Nuss. In our case, the taxpayer's ESBIT trust tax year ended prior to 12/29/00. What issue was in front of the Nuss court? In Nuss, the taxpayer's position was that the only interpretation of the interplay between Section 641 and 671 was that Section 641 trumped 671. That is, the ESBIT trust income was included on the trust 1041 tax return and not included in the individual's 1040 tax return. In Nuss, the tax commissioner's position was that the only interpretation of the interplay between 641 and 671 was that 671 trumped 641. That is, the ESBIT trust income was includable in the individual's 1040 and not on the trust 1041 tax return. I'm here today to tell you that both the taxpayer and the tax commissioner were in error. As I will discuss later, for ESBITs with tax years ended prior to 12/29/00, there is no single correct interpretation. There are multiple reasonable interpretations. The Nuss court.
Has the IRS or any other federal court or agency given us any guidance on this issue for the time period in question?
I'm glad you asked that. If we were given the opportunity to have a Board of Tax Appeals hearing, we intended to introduce the testimony of the IRS author of the Treasury regulations under Section 641, Mr. Brad Poston. My office had contacted Mr. Poston, again, who is the author of the regulations under 641, and posed to him this question: whether a grantor trust which made an ESBIT election must report the ESBIT trust income on the 1040, the individual return, when the ESBIT tax year ended prior to 12/29/00. So if you have a grantor trust that made an ESBIT election, its tax year ended prior to 12/29/00, Mr. Poston, from the IRS's perspective, what do you report it? His response to his question was that for the period of 1/1/00 through 12/28/00, prior to the effective date of the regulations, there was no single correct way to report the ESBIT trust income because there was no regulatory authority which instructed you how to report such income. According to Mr. Poston, the IRS would accept any one of three reasonable interpretations. One, Section 641 overrides Section 671. Two, Section 671 overrides 641. Or three, Section 641 applies to the S-corp portion of the trust and 671 applies to the non-S-corp portion of the trust. If we were given the opportunity for a Board of Tax Appeals hearing, we would have introduced his testimony in that hearing. Prior to that, there isn't anything definitive for that time frame relative to the question.
One question I did wonder about your supplements, counsel, and perhaps this goes to your argument that you didn't have this opportunity at the BTA, but the supplements that you included here, or that you filed here, include some tax returns, of course, and I don't see those in the record from the BTA. So I'm a little confused as to how the court is able to consider those when they're not in the record.
If I recall, they were included as part of the BTA appeal.
Huh. I've got the record, for instance, in the first case here. This is the whole record, and it's just notices of appeal and briefs.
Well, in that particular case, the case was stayed. The tax commissioner had filed a motion to stay the case.
Okay.
So we never had the opportunity to introduce that into evidence.
All right. So these materials in the supplement are not part of the record then?
Correct.
All right.
Again, the Nuss court was given two choices, mutually exclusive options. Which interpretation is correct? Nowhere in the Nuss opinion is the issue of ambiguity in the federal tax law raised for the period of 1100 to 122800. The court was not asked to address this issue. As discussed later on, there is statutory ambiguity. If the issue before the Nuss court was, is there ambiguity in a federal tax statute? Is such ambiguity resolved in favor of the taxpayer? Based upon this court's own precedent, the court would have found for the taxpayer. Under both federal and Ohio law, if a revenue or tax statute is ambiguous, the ambiguity is resolved in favor of the taxpayer. I draw this court's attention to the U.S. Supreme Court case of Gold v. Gould. The U.S. Supreme Court stated that any ambiguity in a revenue statute is resolved in favor of the taxpayer. At the Supreme Court in Columbus Board of Education versus Franklin County Board of Revisions, this court stated that an ambiguous tax provision must be resolved in favor of the taxpayer. The interplay of Section 641 and 671 is ambiguous as it relates to the federal income taxation of a grantor trust, which makes an Nesbitt election. I've already talked about the testimony that we would have introduced relative to Mr. Poston from the IRS. The fact that interpretive regulations were issued highlights the fact that the statute is not clear on its face, as the tax commissioner asserts. In fact, there is statutory ambiguity. In the United States Supreme Court case of Chevron versus Natural Resources, the U.S. Supreme Court set forth a two-part test for testing the validity of a regulation. If a statute is clear on its face, the interpretive regulation is invalid. Now, if we apply the Chevron test to our situation, if Section 641 was clear on its face, as the tax commissioner asserts, then the 641 regulations would be invalid under the Chevron test. I submit that, and as pointed out, no one has challenged the validity of the 641 regulations. And this is due to the fact that the tax statutes in question, 641 and 671, are not clear on their face. There is statutory ambiguity, and hence there is a need for interpretive regulations. If a taxpayer brought an action in federal court contending that the 641 regulations were invalid on the basis that the statute is clear in its face, highly doubtful the taxpayer would be successful. In the tax commissioner's oral argument, he was asked by the court what the purpose of the regulations under 641 were in view of the fact that 641 is clear in its face. The tax commissioner stated that 641 regulations were issued to, quote, clarify the statute. Webster's dictionary definition of clarify, quote, to free of confusion, to make understandable. In the tax commissioner's reply brief, he implicitly admitted that there's ambiguity in the law. He points out that 150 taxpayers had appealed from the Board of Tax Appeals. All these taxpayers had Nesbitt grantor trusts, had reported the Nesbitt income on their trust tax return and not their individual tax return. This means there were literally hundreds of lawyers and CPAs in the state of Ohio which interpreted the applicable tax law differently than the commissioner. If you accept the commissioner's position that the statute was clear in its face, he's suggesting that all these lawyers and CPAs were advising their clients to violate federal tax law. I believe that's a ridiculous proposition. In the tax commissioner's information release from 12/29/0 or from January of 2000, He stated in there and announced that an ESBIT trust is not eligible to be a grantor trust. Now, this information release was issued 11 months prior to the regulations being issued. 11 months later, the regulations come up, and what the regulations say is that a grantor trust is eligible to be an ESBIT trust. So the tax commissioner's information release was incorrect. Now, why was it incorrect? Because the statute is not clear in its face. There's ambiguity in the law. His information itself, release itself, establishes that by his incorrect interpretation of what the regulation subsequently stated. In the tax commissioner's January 2000 information release, again, he states and admits the ambiguity in this area by stating, quote, "The Income Tax Audit Division recognizes that various tax practitioners have differing interpretations of how the ESBIT provisions interplay with the grantor trust provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. Some have advocated that the ESBIT provisions should take precedence over the grantor trust provisions, while others believe that the grantor trust cannot make the ESBIT election." Finally, and as previously discussed, another factor which distinguishes our case from the NUST situation is that in these taxpayer cases, their tax year ended prior to 12/29/00. In his oral argument in NUST, the tax commissioner's position was that the NUST trust tax year ended 12/31/00, not before 12/29/00. Under the facts of NUST, the Supreme Court found that the tax year of the NUST trust ended on 12/31/00. In that opinion, the Supreme Court's decision in NUST suggests that if NUST would have established that their ESBIT trust tax year ended prior to 12/29/00, a different result would have occurred. In fact, in Justice O'Donnell's dissenting opinion, she points out that the majority relied on its decision on the fact that the NUST trust tax year did not end prior to 12/29/00. As Justice O'Donnell in the NUST opinion correctly points out, Section 443 of the Internal Revenue Code provides that an ESBIT trust tax year ends when the taxpayer ceases to exist, regardless of the date indicated on the tax return. If the taxpayers in this case would have been given the opportunity to have a Board of Tax Appeals hearing, they would have established that their tax year ended prior to 12/29/00. Unless there are any other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Hubbard.
Good morning, Your Honor. I was the counsel in the Canoes versus Wilkins case, and so I can appreciate Mr. Carcero's attributing certain things to the commissioner's position, as I was the architect of that language, I guess. One of the things that Mr. Carcero said is that I had said that the reg clarifies the statute. Actually, the terminology I used was it confirms what the statute says. It reinforces what the statute says. It applies the statute. And that's what this court said in Canoost. It said that under the relevant federal income tax statutes, the income from some Chapter S shares held in a grantor trust is taxed to the grantor, not to the grantor trust. And the court said that the regulation merely reinforced the statute. And we maintain that that's exactly what the regulation does.
How do you address this argument that this fellow Poston felt the need to say that there was ambiguity from the federal government's perspective?
First of all, Your Honor, there was no testimony presented in the show cause proceedings. The taxpayer in this case had a full opportunity to present affidavits or anything else. What they did instead was just to make a general allegation in their brief. In the proceedings below, the Board of Tax Appeals asked the taxpayer to show cause why the case should not be affirmed on the basis of the Canoes decision. And at that point, it would have been incumbent upon opposing counsel to have presented that actual testimony as opposed to merely making an allegation in the brief. And secondly, I guess I would say, and perhaps more fundamentally, what the alleged architect of a reg or author of a regulation would say about it would hardly be controlling as to what the statute itself says. The statute is extremely clear. There's no trumping going on here. What we have are two sections of the Internal Revenue Code one, the grantor trust provision in 671, and the other, the small business electing small business trust provision, 641C. 641C incorporates by reference 671 because it provides the tax treatment to be accorded the electing small business trust is to be determined by reference to the chapter generally, which includes section 671. This is not a situation where you have two sections and you have to choose which one supersedes the other. The later enacted section, 641C, by its very terms, incorporates 671, with the exceptions that are provided for in paragraph 2 of 641C. And so there's a carve-out from the general rules. 641C2 provides that certain exceptions to the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code generally.
What was the point of issuing the federal regulation? And I guess this information.
Your Honor, that's a very good question. What it simply did is it applied the statute very specifically. If you look at that provision, and I did just in preparation for this a few hours ago, it basically repeats much of the same language that's in the code itself, but it simply amplifies it in terms of practically saying how it applies. So actually, under their supposition, you could have a regulation that simply parroted the statute. A lot of our regulations in Ohio, the tax commissioner issues his own regulations and rules, and frequently they just adopt the exact language of the statute. And in this instance, there's a lot of duplication between the regulation and the statute, but the statute expressly says that you look to the other provisions of the code. All they've done is incorporate those provisions in 671 directly instead of by reference. So, and I think it's an aid to taxpayers that you get a regulation rather than cross-referencing to 671 and the regulations thereunder, as applied to ESBITs, that is, electing small business trusts that have shares in subchapter S corporations as part of the corpus. There is a specific reg, so you don't have to cross-reference. That's what the intent of that was, and that's what it did. And that's what this court held. This court in Canoost didn't actually, despite Mr. Carcero saying that they didn't address where there's any ambiguity, that was precisely what the court addressed. I mean, they held that under the plain terms of the relevant federal income tax statutes, the income from the grantor trust is taxed to the grantor and not to the grantor trust itself. And that's so whether the income's from a subchapter S corporation, which it is here, or generally. That's how grantor trusts are generally taxed. That is, they're not taxed. The income isn't taxed at the grantor trust level. It's taxed at the grantor level.
I take it there's never been any official statement from the federal government about the taxability of these trusts.
That's right, Your Honor. In other words, I looked to see whether I couldn't find any, and opposing counsel couldn't find any. There were no cases that I could find where anybody has taken a position counter to the position that Ohio has taken here. I mean,
yeah, I didn't see any state decisions from other states. Is that your finding?
That's my finding too. I mean, I think, and my answer to that is, the reason for that is it is extremely clear. I mean, it's a very straightforward application of the statute, and that's what we asked the court to look at before. There's no ambiguity. 641C incorporates by reference the other sections of the federal income tax chapter, which is the entire income tax code, including section 671. And actually, the grantor trust provisions go from 671 through 679, so it would incorporate all of those. And the regulations under 671 clearly provide that for the treatment that was given here, that the income from the grantor trust is taxed to the grantor. And of course, if you think about it in terms of what a grantor trust is, a grantor does not relinquish. When the grantor creates the grantor trust and becomes the beneficiary, essentially they're dealing with themselves. I mean, to treat that as a separate taxable entity and then allow that entity, which at the time was not subject, all trusts in Ohio weren't, there were, under our personal income tax law, trusts were not subject to Ohio taxation. So that would allow a very powerful income tax avoidance device that anybody that had subchapter S income, owned a business, could escape Ohio income tax merely by this simple expedient of creating a one-sheet piece of paper, creating a grantor trust. And that would be a very dangerous thing to be able to do. I mean, you know, our income tax system would essentially disintegrate if we had that as a device. And so, I mean, it's a very serious matter for the state of Ohio to win this case, and I thought the court did an excellent and very cogent job in articulating why the commissioner and the BTA were correct. In fact, a lot better job than I did, frankly. If there are any further questions, I'd be glad to entertain them.
Are there other cases like this in the pipeline below?
There are a few. The Board of Tax Appeals issued, and Mr. Crocero was very much correct, there are about 150 cases initially on this issue. 30 taxpayers, at least 30, voluntarily dismissed their appeals, even without that was after the board issued a show cause order. Prior to that point, there were many others that had already dismissed. And I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was in the 80s or so, of actual decisions issued by the board affirming the commissioner on the basis of Knust, including these five cases. There's a case at the Court of Appeals, Renacci, that I'm currently briefing. And then more recently, Mr. Crocero, I believe, filed a case in Bolsa, and I think that was the case where he had fired an amicus brief on behalf of Mr. Bolsa involving the Knust litigation. And then there's another case filed not by Mr. Crocero's firm, but by another firm, Brown. And to my knowledge, that's it. That's the end of the road. The reason I think the Brown case and Renacci came later, they came after the five cases involved here, is that there were some discovery disputes, and so there was additional time for that to be resolved. And that just delayed the board's ultimate decision in the case. And I think the dollars in those cases were very significant. I think the Vestfall case of the five here has a fairly large dollar amount, and these other two cases did too. And I think that might be one reason why they're simply being cautionary in terms of protective appeal.
Do you have any thoughts on the record in this case? I'm a little unsure how to deal with that. We've got supplements which have lots of helpful information in them, but this isn't in the record. So I'm
Vestfall,
not sure what the court will do with that.
The lead case, Vestfall, I think actually the tax commissioner prepared a statutory transcript that was certified to the board, and I believe that is part of the record here. In terms of the close of the taxable year and whether that's important, what we would say is the taxpayer had the opportunity to present whatever evidence they were going to argue concerning the close of the taxable year in their in the show cause. Pursuant to the show cause order, again, they could have attached that documentation. But in any event, I believe that the court's case and the decision, the holding of Knust v. Wilkins, wasn't based on the existence of the federal regulation, that even without that regulation, the income tax statutes themselves, the federal income tax statutes, clearly provide for the basis for the holding in this case, that the grantor, the income from the grantor trust is taxable to the grantor and not to the grantor trust itself. That comes directly from the statute. So, but what I would say is, to the extent that it's not on the record, that's something that was incumbent upon the taxpayer to have presented. With respect to the returns themselves, I don't think there's any material question that those are the returns. So I don't know how we'd want to handle that. I would say that in the Vestfall case, the return is a part of the record. That's the lead case. I think their arguments are, if you read the briefs, you'll see that the arguments are identical in each case. So I'm not, I think in light of that, I would admit that it's somewhat problematic, but I think in the end, it shouldn't make any difference. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Mr. Corsaro, you have about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. Mr. Hubbard, I think, did a nice job of giving you a reasonable interpretation of the interplay of 641 and 671, which is, I think, exactly the point. He points out the statute says any chapter under 641, which incorporates 671. However, Section 641C says, for purposes of this chapter, the portion of any electing small business trust, which consists of stock in one or more S corporations, shall be treated as a separate trust. Shall be treated as a separate trust. And then 641C then goes on to compute the tax on that separate trust. 671 says that the taxable income of a grantor is included, the taxable income of a trust is included in the grantor's income to the extent that income would be included in the individual's income. Well, you've got 641C, which says that you treat an SBIT with S Corp shares as a separate trust. And you got 671, which says you ignore the trust. That is a classic case of statutory ambiguity. I agree. I think Mr. Hubbard has a reasonable interpretation of that. I think another reasonable interpretation is when you look at 641C, the fact that it imposes a special tax, the fact that it says you shall treat an S Corp or a trust with S Corp shares in it as a separate trust is conceptually different than a grantor trust where you ignore the trust. I think that helps establish that there's ambiguity. One of the questions asked was, what was the point of the federal regulations? The real reason for those regulations was due to Section 945 of the code. Apparently, if you look at the IRS's hit list of tax shelters, there were taxpayers in Guam who had set up S-Corps with S-Bits in October, November of 2000, and were apparently not paying federal income tax. The IRS on December 27th announced they were going to issue regulations on the 29th. The reason why they came out in such a hurry was because of that Guam situation. In terms of other states being concerned of this, I think as Mr. Hubbard knows, I believe there were only 3 states at the time that did not tax trusts. So it wasn't a situation where this issue really affected a lot of other states. Again, his last point, the court has already addressed the issue of ambiguity. Again, I would respectfully disagree. Nowhere in that opinion does it mention anything about ambiguity. The court was not asked to address that issue. Again, the court was given mutually exclusive options. Which one is the correct interpretation? Again, these taxpayers submit that there are multiple reasonable interpretations.
Thank you, Mr. Corsaro.
Thank you.
And the case will be submitted to the court. Thank you, counsel.
All rise. This open session of the Office of Supreme Court of Ohio.